Kulturi, an encounter with people of different cultures. Welcome to another program, Kulturi, and today we are discussing Palestine, and our guest is not new to this station, because she is Miss Mays Tayem, and she anchors the program Is Debatable. She is a student in the International Relations Department of the Faculty of Arts, and she was brought up, she's a Palestinian, brought up in the West Bank in Nablus. So good day, Miss Tayem.
Thank you.
And the first thing I'd like to ask you, a question which I ask every guest of this program, is how would you describe, or what would you say are the main values of Palestinian society, or in Palestinian culture, if you want?
Okay, well, first of all, what I would like to say that Palestine is the birthplace of the main three religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. And to be honest, religion has a big impact on the daily life. Moreover, our societies are very traditional, they're very family-oriented, they're very forgiving people, they're very honest people. We cherish loyalty, we cherish friendship, also neighborhood. We always have a good relationship with our neighbors. What else could I say?
Neighborhood, you mean cross-border neighbors, or
no,
within Palestine?
No, I mean
itself?
The society.
Within society.
I mean, even neighbors, they, like, in a week, like, they should pay short visits to each other where they have coffee and exchange sweets. Moreover, I think another...
This is very important to say it in Malta, because very often we think that we are the only hospitable people. I have been both to the northern shores of the Mediterranean and to the southern shores, and once only in Israel, and I find that hospitality is a mark of the Mediterraneans.
Of course, I think it's an important feature.
So it's good to speak about this hospitality. How do you express this hospitality in Palestine mostly?
Okay, well, many people, when they come visiting Palestine, the first thing they notice is when they go visiting locals, they approach them with trays of tea and sweets. And actually, when they're sitting in one visit, they may be served drinks for more than one time, and when coffee comes, that means it's the end of the visit. So what you should say, you just drink your coffee and leave, like after a few words of like exchanging greetings, goodbye greetings. Also, I think it's very impolite to refuse when somebody's serving you something. So perhaps, like, even if you're not a tea drinker, what you should do, you should take the cup of tea, sip it, and put it on the table. You don't have to finish it, but it would be very impolite to just refuse it.
Oh, this happened to me personally when I was in Rome.
Uh-huh.
I was to assist, we were house blessing, and I went to a Sicilian, and they offered a drink. And they said, I'm not drinking, you know, I have a long way to go. And they were almost sad, so I drank, and really I had to go home, because they gave me such a strong Sicilian liqueur that I couldn't go on. And another thing here this time, recently I had a visit from a Jewish rabbi who is also a professor in the United States. And a friend of mine invited us for tea. And as you say, because he is very kosher, so he was given a sweet, he opened it, he read the instructions, and he didn't comment anything. Uh-huh. But he didn't eat it, but as a compliment, he opened the sweet. So it exists in the Middle East, and I think in Malta we've taken the idea, many of us, it's either yes or a no. Very often, I think it is more Maltese that people would first say yes, say no, and then they will say yes.
Mm-hmm.
So an example, they feel they shouldn't say yes immediately as a sign of being polite, but then they accept your offer. So again, our hospitality is very quite similar. I mean, we offer a drink normally, as you say, it's a coffee or a soft drink. Normally nowadays, a soft drink, they offer you a soft drink or a coffee or tea, and if it's winter, perhaps an alcoholic drink. But the main virtue, as you say, is human relationships.
Yes.
And the main is loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important. And let's go on the opposite side. What would be, so to say, when would it be considered to be a deviant in a Palestinian society? I'm not referring to crimes like killing and stealing and so on, because I assume that Palestinians would consider you a deviant as any other civilized nation. But what are the other deviancies which you should be a local to notice, so to say?
Would you mean as like things unacceptable in the society?
In a sense, that's what I mean. Not illegal, I mean. They go against the norm of society, you know, or the tradition of society.
The things that exist or should not exist now?
I mean, the thing which people today wouldn't like one doing.
Okay. Oh, well, let me think. Well, first of all, our people very much hate oppression.
Oppression, yeah.
Because we are people of... Well, we had since 1948 and even before, we had that fight for our freedoms, for our land, which was taken mm-hmm. away from us. And so we really don't appreciate oppression. And we like that everyone to be heard and everyone's right to be respected.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, we don't appreciate when people cheat, whether that was in business or in social relations. For example... there are very social, like heavy social repercussions on those cheating spouses.
On cheating spouses?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do they separate normally or do they seek for divorce for cheating?
Well, no, they usually like divorce.
Divorce?
Yes.
Not simply separation.
Because I don't think it's something acceptable because, as I mentioned in the beginning, we're very family-centric and family means a lot to us, and just like betraying that holicity of this such union, it's considered something really big.
As you know, one of the main issues about which one can read hundreds of books in contemporary sociology is the issue of trust.
Mm-hmm.
How do Palestinians feel about trust?
I think we're very...
Do they feel that trust among the younger generation, so to say, not younger in age, about recent generation, is being weakened, or that it is still as it used to be?
Well, being Palestinian, coming from Palestine, I think it does not get weakened by time because we have a strong cause, and that we get raised believing and trusting in our cause that in the future we should hold grip of our land, of our future, and maybe then in later days we would reach that objective, that aim. And so our trust should not be weakened or should not be moved by whatever difficulties we're facing.
Mm. But, I mean, yesterday there was an article in the Times of Malta about most of these politicians, which was rather hard on politicians, saying that most of them, I wouldn't even use the word used, but there was quite a hard word about them. And since it's escaping me, I wouldn't risk using a word which the author didn't use, but there's one of the main businessmen in Malta who was very hard with politicians. Are the Palestinians hard with their politicians in their critique? Do they trust a lot their politicians, or do they say these are all made of the same bunch, you know, whether it's on the right, on the left, wherever you are? There seems to be a lack of trust in the West, in most countries. Politicians are falling into distrust. It's very unfortunate because society needs politicians, but if they lose trust, it means that we'll become almost society without any leadership.
Well, I would like to say about our president, Mahmoud Abbas Abu Mazen, he's a very good man. He has done a lot for our cause, and people trust him, and I think that trust was renewed when he went last year for the United Nations to ask for the recognition of Palestine as a member, a permanent member in the UN. I think he's doing all what he can. We are a democratic state. Unfortunately, we can't hold elections because of international and also like local restrictions of the current situation. But if he had the chance, he wouldn't stop like to hold an election.
Mm-hmm.
And even he himself, he said that if there will be an election, they will be running again. Not that there is anything wrong about him, but I think he's a great man in that term which he ruled. Like great changes were made, mm-hmm. were brought more into development and modernization. And I think he believes that maybe later people can do even more for our country.
At present, what is the main economic base of the Palestinian, let's call it Palestinian territory, for
yes.
lack of a better word? I know it's, you can call it a state. It is also recognized in certain countries like Malta. It has diplomatic relations as if it were a state. So, but what is the main basis of the Palestinian economy?
Well, actually preparing for today's episode, I was doing some background reading and I found out that Palestine's economy is mostly agricultural. We depend most on our land crops, which half of it consists of olives.
Mm-hmm.
We produce oil, we produce soap. Actually, my city, Nablus, it's known for like the central city for soap production. And we also made different touristic statues, I don't know.
Oh, yes, souvenirs.
Souvenirs, different souvenirs. Also, we have fruits.
Are they made manually?
Yeah, I think they're made manually.
So you don't have Hong Kongization of souvenirs,
no,
you
not
know,
yet.
Everything made in China.
Yes, yes.
Representing Maltese flags in China, so
on. Moreover, we also have some factories, not in such a big expenditure because of Israel, it puts restriction on our production. So we produce as well oils, we produce sweets, we produce, what else? We produce medicines and plastic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what are the main, how do you celebrate the main rituals, what we can call the rites of passage? So for example, how is birth celebrated?
Mm-hmm.
How is when someone becomes an adult, transition to adulthood celebration? How are marriages celebrated?
Okay, well, to start about marriage, this decision is mainly made by future spouses, but members of the family, parents, brothers, sisters also express their opinion. This consultation is usually a formality, but it should not be skipped. So when a man would like to propose for a woman, he should come with his family and also like friends and members of his village or his neighborhood, and they should all come in a big group to propose for this girl. And then when the father tells him, well, I give you my daughter, they read the Quran, they read the Fatiha, and then they announce like that they're engaged. Well, that's in Islamic traditions. To be honest, I don't know much about Christian traditions in this matter.
Mm-hmm.
But also we have the traditional element, even with Christians, that it's the family that approaches the family of the bride and not the man comes by himself,
mm-hmm.
or only proposes to the female.
Do pre-arranged marriages still exist?
They do. So perhaps a man would propose to a girl and then they spend their engagement period of 2 months, usually on average, getting to know each other.
No, I mean pre-arranged. I mean pre-arranged between parents.
I don't think so. I think the most, if like the thing that's ranked in my mind is traditional marriages, that perhaps like a guy has heard about the good morals of like a pretty girl and he would wish to marry her, so he sends his family over.
He sends his family to discuss the issue with her family.
Yes. He would be present, of course, but he wouldn't go by himself.
Mm-hmm. And suppose, you know, here in what we can call, I mean, I don't know what to call it, I mean, European, let's call it European and American. Boys and girls start going out frequently and they change girlfriends and boyfriends and all that, went before settling with one. Is this the practice in Palestine, or normally there is much thought before going out with a girl, otherwise society wouldn't look nicely on you?
I think it becomes more normal within university years. Because, for example, high school education Palestine between public schools is girls alone and guys alone, so there isn't much space for the sexes to meet. But when you come to university and you attend lectures together, I think there's more interaction between the sexes. So perhaps, like, I don't know, two people, a girl and a guy, they start being fond of each other. But eventually, like, even when they start dating, they put in mind that they should engage, like, in the future, or maybe they will get those, like, looks from society. Although, like, I think in bigger cities it's more normal for girls and guys to go out together, but not in all.
How is divorce looked at in Palestine? Is it taken lightly? Suppose a family, I mean, know that one of their children is divorcing his wife or their daughter is divorcing her husband. Would that be taken as a shock, in a sense, culturally?
Well, I know this is wrong to say, but I think it depends on the family. Like, yeah. if the female comes from a respectful family, a big family, nobody would say there's anything bad about her. They say, oh, he was bad, or oh, they did work out between them. But if it was like a poor girl, not poor girl as in senses like of finances, but like, you know, she doesn't have a back or something and she divorces, she gets that stigma, that look from the society, oh, she's a divorced.
Mm-hmm. Can a woman ask for divorce, or only men can ask for divorce?
Yes, a woman can ask for a divorce, but she should have like some legit reasons, like, for example, medical conditions from her husband's side or from her side, or that her husband is treating her unkindly, or that he's been away for so long, away from her. Mm-hmm. So she can go to court and present her reasons, and if the court finds those reasons abiding, they can even like grant her that she keeps the money that she got while marrying the man.
Mm-hmm. The dowry.
Yes.
But is it easier for a man to ask for divorce than it is for a woman?
Well, if a man asks for divorce, he has to pay a woman, which is called in Arabic mu'akhar, which means the late amount. Because when people get married, they agree on three amounts of money. Usually they're equal to each other, mm-hmm. Which was the pre-amount, the money for furniture, and the late amount. So the pre-amount, the woman, she uses it to buy clothes, to prepare for herself to getting into her wed life. Mm-hmm. The furniture money is to furnish the house, of course. Mm-hmm. And the late amount is in case the man asks for a divorce, for the woman not to be left, as I told you, like for the society and having nothing. Mm-hmm. She should have that money to put her back on her feet.
Mm-hmm. Are women encouraged to work outside their family unit nowadays, or that is to work in factories, I mean?
Well, I think in the last 20 years, we have a fashion of women going more into job places. Well, I don't think in factories, to be honest. Or maybe some female, like, production things, like clothes, like hands.
Textile industry, yeah. And so on.
Yes. But mostly we have a lot of engineer women, a lot of doctors, a lot of accountants. In offices they work. And also what I would like to say is that the highest literacy rate in the Arabic world is recorded in Palestine and Jordan. Mm-hmm. Actually, I have some statistics from a consensus study that was made in 2008, and it reports that the literacy rates for girls and boys are 97.5% for girls and 96.6% for boys.
Quite high, even for girls. It is very high. Yeah, but you're telling me that those who engage in work, women who engage mm-hmm. in work outside home,
yes,
are those who are better educated.
I believe so, yes.
So, and the rest are mainly, are they expected to stay at home in the traditional way that every traditional society holds that the place of women was to stay at home, or perhaps in cottage industry, I mean, perhaps if they have some cows or goats and so on, and do work which can be done at home. For example, I remember Maltese women working a lot at home. I mean, Maltese women, I mean, didn't, it doesn't mean Maltese women didn't do any work besides family work. I mean, I know I live, I come from a village, from Asha, and many women used to work in the fields while their husband used to work somewhere else, perhaps, and they used to graze their sheep and so on, or prepare ricotta at home and then go and sell it. Again, many women used to go and cut capers and then sold them, and then go to Hamrun to sell them, or go to Sliema. So that type of cottage industry existed, in which mostly women were involved. Women were involved. How is this, does the situation exist in Palestine?
I believe that Palestinian women are very hardworking women, and they understand that because of our local situation, it's not easy anymore for the man to work on his own. Like, the woman should also help to bring money to the house, to buy food, to pay the bills, and so on. And I believe mostly there are higher chances to go and find job outside the house than within. But from inside the houses, for example, I know there are NGOs that give women who are not capable of finding a job in an office or so, they give them job where they can bring home, which are like in textiles. We made those hand wooden mirrors. They're of Palestinian folklore. They're very beautiful and they're very pricey. We have also the traditional costume. When we have foreigners that are coming from abroad, they might even find a dress. They may pay for it over 1,000 euros. So I think...
Because they are craftwork.
Yes, yes.
Not I mean factory work, but craftwork, which is all over the world, more expensive and in a sense, not in a sense, in every sense, much more appreciated than having, I mean, something which is of mass production.
Yeah, but I believe that mostly women, they work outside the house in Palestine nowadays.
Nowadays more so.
Yes.
I know Islamic culture accepts polygamy. So how is polygamy practiced in Palestine? Is it a common feature, or is it only practiced by rich men, or and the law, how many women does the law allow the husband to have? For example, I know that in Egypt it's a law that a man, even if he is rich, couldn't have more than three wives.
Well, by Islamic tradition, a man is allowed to marry four, but he should have legit reasons for why he should have that many. But in Palestine, I believe that for many years now, there's been the trend that a man could only have one woman because it's already like expensive to afford one, and never mind her children and his children and so on. But we also may find people who have two, but I don't think it's that quite common.
When I was in Zambia, where polygamy also exists, in traditional Zambia, I mean, which used to exist, I mean, even Christianity found it difficult to stop the tradition. That is, it is so to say, a pre-European and a pre-Islamic, the existence of polygamy in sub-Saharan Africa. I was told that the tradition was that the men would marry one woman first, and then it is the woman who asks him to marry another woman. In a sense, okay, she will be his wife, but the first woman will be, so to say, the primus inter pares, so the first among them. So in a sense, she should help. The house is essentially run hierarchically by the first woman, unless, of course, there is trouble. But then there is the issue of divorce.
Well, I might have a similar story, but not about polygamy, because, as I mentioned, in Palestine, like, some might have two women, but that's very rare. Like, it happens maybe in rural Palestine, in the villages and so on, but it's much rarer and happening on many less occasions in the cities. Now, about bringing a woman to the house to help you, that, for example, happens when a mother finds a bride for her son. Mostly, like, all those sons and daughters, they move away from the house once they get married. It happens that the oldest son, he still lives with his parents. Not that he lives in their house, he might move to another house, but he should bring his parents with him to take care of them. So what happens usually that, well, in some occasions, maybe the mother would mistreat this new bride and tell her, like, to do stuff around the house for her and such.
So the eldest son still have great responsibility.
Yes.
With regards to his parents.
Yes, he does.
But what if the firstborn would be a girl? Would it be the same or not?
No, it would not be. It would be always the eldest son. Because, for example, the eldest son, he preserves the continuation of the family line.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if your first son was called Khaled, you would be called Abu Khaled, the father of Khaled, mm-hmm. and your madam would be Im Khaled, the mother of Khaled. And then so on, when he has his first eldest son, the tradition goes that the son names his son after him. So he would name his son Khaled, and so on.
Oh, again, even in our culture, we have the tradition of naming children after grandparents
yes.
or relatives when they die. You know. One last question. What is the most exotic food in Palestine?
Oof, that's a difficult question indeed. Well, to be honest, I don't think anything exotic because it's very normal to me. I love all our food. We mostly like lamb. We like chicken. We like rice. We like herbs, a lot of herbs. They're used like quite often. But I think perhaps one most popular dish is called mansaf. And it's rice with meat and cold yogurt. And you need to make bowls with your hands and then you throw it in your mouth. So I think that tradition of eating the rice with your hands is quite exotic.
And do you use honey a lot with your sweets?
Yes, we do a lot. But it's usually water with sugar.
Water with sugar?
Yes, and you make it like thick on the water.
Because honey would be more expensive. I think traditionally it was honey. You know,
yeah. yeah, could be.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sayem.
Thank you.
I hope you'll have a successful continuation of your course and a very good mark in your final degree. Thanks to our listeners, and we'll be with you again next week. Thank you very much.